Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We spend the half hour listening to a talk by Professor Mazen B. Kumsia. In March, he visited his former alma mater, the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut, as part of a book tour for his latest work about Palestinian empowerment. Had Mazen Kumsia been an activist working on rights in Tripoli, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, or even China, his name might be more widely recognized in the United States. Still, there is a growing level of support for nonviolent activism in Palestine and for the boycott, divestment, sanction movement that's taken hold in the United States, Europe, and even Israel. Mazen Kumsia teaches at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities in Palestine and was formerly a Yale University professor in New Haven, Connecticut. He's currently on a U.S. tour with his new book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment.
When did the first Palestinian resistance start to this political Zionist project? Of course, Palestinians had resisted other things. For example, they did resist the Ottoman Empire. But I was curious about when did they actually start resisting the political Zionist ideas. Of course, Palestinians did not resist cultural Zionist or religious Zionist ideas, which have to do with people coming into the land, building institutions, whatever, without the idea of controlling and transforming Palestine from a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society into a Jewish state. This is political Zionism, and we should differentiate it from other ideas. We Palestinians, of course, have welcomed people from various backgrounds to come live in Palestine. For example, we have Druze, Cherkess, Armenians, Ethiopians, etc. And also Jews after the Russian pogroms came to Palestine and settled there, and we had no problem with that. The Armenians actually have an Armenian quarter in Jerusalem, and they became naturalized Palestinians, treated equally like all of us. We had multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. My grandfather's friend in school was Jewish. My grandfather was Christian. So you can see we didn't have these, and that was under the Ottoman Empire, of course. The problem started in the 19th century, and it was this Germanic idea. A Germanic idea of political Zionism. And I say Germanic idea for anybody who wants to study history, they'll find that it was originated by German-speaking minority of Jews, not all Jews. In fact, the majority of Jews were opposed to this notion of political Zionism. And it was started well before Herzl, by the way. In the mid to 19th century, with the collaboration of people like Rothschild family in England and others who put some money behind the idea. But 1880s, when the first permanent solid Zionist colony was established in Palestine with the intention of creating a Jewish state. And it was so clear from the writings that that's what they intended. In German, of course, all the writings was in German. And the Palestinians were not ignorant of this. There were many Palestinians who were highly educated. Actually, my own role model and hero, if you want, is a guy by the name of Ruhi al-Khalidi, who read the early 1870s manifestos, if you want, of Zionism in German, because he taught himself German specifically to understand what this was about. And in the 1880s, he led nonviolent demonstrations against this project. So the first nonviolent demonstrations actually occurred in 1881. And so we are talking about 130 years of popular resistance in Palestine against this project. And actually, between 1881 and the 1920s, Palestinians engaged in solely nonviolent resistance. Only in the 1920s, some Palestinians decided to pick up arms and fight against the British occupation and its concordant support of the Zionist project. So nearly 45 to 50 years passed before Palestinians decided to take up armed resistance. Now, when we talk about popular resistance, I should be very clear and define what I'm talking about. What is nonviolent resistance? I actually don't use the term nonviolent resistance. As you see, the title of the book is Popular Resistance in Palestine. In Arabic also, we don't use the name Muqawama al-Unfiyya. We use this term, which is Muqawama al-Sha'biyya, Popular Resistance. This is because, just like Mahatma Gandhi also didn't call his nonviolent resistance nonviolent, he called it with terms like Satyagraha and Ahimsa, which were more encompassing and more positive terms than just simply the issue of nonviolence. We're not doing this to be against violence or nonviolence or limiting it to this notion of nonviolence. It is a whole set of procedures and practices that allows people to do resistance without physically harming the opponent. Given that, what are the types of nonviolent resistance, or popular resistance as the more proper term is? There's an author by the name of Gene Sharp, an American author, whose books were translated into Arabic in the early 1980s, actually, and helped with our with that uprising of 1987, actually. But Gene Sharp says in one of his books that there are 199 forms of nonviolent resistance or popular resistance. I don't know why he couldn't come up with one more and make it an even 200, but that case as it may be. I actually counted that we Palestinians have used not only those 199 forms that are mentioned by Gene Sharp, but many, many more, even before the 1920s. Everything from civil disobedience to boycotts to refusing to obey orders at checkpoints, etc., to sticking to our land, what we call sumud or persistence. All of these techniques were practiced long before that period. So I'm going to read to you part of my book in the 1920s. I mentioned that the first Palestinian nonviolent resistance in Palestine started in 1881. That, if you want, is what's called in Arabic the first intifada. Intifada is uprising or shaking off, as we say in Arabic. Since then, by the way, we have had a minimum of 14 uprisings or intifadas. Minimum, because some of them were smaller and you could count them too, if you want. But the 1920 to 21 uprising was particularly interesting uprising because it's an uprising that set the stage for the massive violence that the British proceeded to do on the Palestinians afterwards. You see, in 1920, when the British finally got the mandate over Palestine, they appointed a Zionist by the name of Herbert Samuel to rule Palestine. And he was actually the first king of Palestine, if you want, in many, many thousands of years. He had executive power, legislative power, everything in his hands. He could do anything he wants to. And he proceeded to promulgate laws about land transfer to the Zionist movement, etc. So the Palestinians started to object to this. My grandfather, for example, was one of the people who resigned his job in protesting this appointment of Herbert Samuel. Concomitant with his appointment, which came in June, actually June 20th was when he was appointed. In June 23rd, the Muslim Christian Society sent a letter of protestation about this, saying, how could you do this to us Palestinians? We cannot live in a society that is ruled by somebody who not only represented the Zionist movement, but had articulated repeatedly how he's going to go about transforming Palestine to a Jewish state. This is his words. You know, he said, we need to change this country from what it is now to a Jewish state. This is what Herbert Samuel said. So the Muslim Christian Society protested on 23rd of June, and then they started to organize for the next, which was the third Palestinian Arab Congress. And I'll start here on page 57, for those of you who have books at the bottom. The third Palestinian Arab Congress was held in Haifa in December 14, 1920, and repeated calls to repudiate the Balfour Declaration and promote self-determination. This placed Haifa on the map of cities of resistance and organization. But this Congress faced new challenges. The exile of Faisal from Syria and the events in Iraq showed that the British and French occupiers had succeeded in bringing an end to the idea of a pan-Arab state, or even a united Bilad al-Sham. This set the stage for Palestinians to reevaluate and refocus on a narrower form of Palestinian nationalism. The Congress elected an executive committee headed by Musa Kadhim al-Husseini. When Samuel showed no interest in responding to their demands, the executive committee traveled to Cairo to meet Winston Churchill, then British colonial secretary. But the latter merely agreed to hear their views when he visited Jerusalem. They did indeed meet in Jerusalem on March 8, 1921, where their demands included no national home for Jews in Palestine, the end to immigration and land transfer, a national government to represent all the people of Palestine, Christian, Muslim, and Jews, and no separation of Palestine from its neighboring areas. Churchill rejected all these demands and told those gathered that self-determination would only come after, quote-unquote, our children's children has died. While Churchill was delivering an insulting speech on March 18, 1921, in which he glorified the Crusaders and the Maccabees, a day of general strikes and protests was called for throughout Palestine, and one demonstration was met with a hail of British bullets, killing several people. At the funeral of two others who had died also in a nonviolent demonstration before, Edward Mansour and Mustafa al-Ajuz. By the way, Edward Mansour is Christian and Mustafa al-Ajuz were Muslims. They were the first two martyrs of this uprising, one Christian young man, 19-year-old, and one Muslim young man, 21-year-old. In the demonstration in Tulkarm, thousands gathered and marched from the southern edge of town towards a government building. The march was led by students, followed by religious leaders, Christian and Muslim, tribal and political leaders, merchants and ordinary people, all carrying black flags. In Haifa, a Christian child and a Muslim man was killed in a demonstration also held in defiance of a ban. Anyway, that uprising, 1920-21, was ended by British brutality. And in the 1920s, interestingly, the British, though, tried to compromise some aspect of this by creating a Palestinian self-government. I shouldn't say try to compromise, try to go around the demands of the demonstrators by creating what's called a self-government for the Palestinians and a Palestinian authority with Palestinian police force that was supposed to, so that the British soldiers don't have to kill Palestinians, it would be Palestinians who would kill other Palestinians. In the 1920s, 26, 27, by the way, also another interesting phenomena happened is that there was a proliferation of Palestinian factions. And in 1927, there were over 30 Palestinian factions, and they were all fighting with each other, not happy with each other. They were into two large blocks, one that was, quote-unquote, accommodating to the British, and one that was the rejectionist to the British. Does this ring a bell with you with today's history with, you know, the Palestinian factions that are fighting with each other, so to speak? The other thing that happened is that these factions became more narrowly constructed with their own leadership and disconnected from the pulse of the street. And if you went in 1927 and 28 on the street and asked people, and I looked at memoirs and things like that, you would find that the Palestinians mistrusted those leadership, both the rejectionist front, so-called rejectionist front, and the more accommodationist front. They distrusted both. Another condition, by the way, that's present today. And the third interesting thing that happened in the late 1920s also is that the political process was frozen. Which happens before every uprising, the political process is frozen. The British had basically thought that by putting police officers on the street and by actually their violence in 1920-21 uprising, that they have ended the possibility of any future Palestinian uprisings. And this reminded me of just 6 months ago or a year ago, Israeli chief intelligence testified before the Knesset, saying the likelihood of a Palestinian uprising is virtually null. It could not happen. And now, a few months later, they changed their view after seeing the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. So I found that before every uprising, there's those three conditions present about Palestinian leadership, about the divisions in the Palestinian leadership, and their disconnection from the people, and about the political process being frozen. And the fourth condition I found that happens before every one of those uprisings, in studying this history, is fascinating, is that the occupiers, colonizers, get too arrogant, and they start thrashing around and making stupid mistakes. And I think this happened, for example, in the uprising of 1987, when Rabin ordered his soldiers to break the bones of Palestinian children. And, of course, literally, they were taking Palestinian children and breaking both their long bones, their legs bones. In one story in Huwara that was published in an Israeli paper, Haaretz, at the time, they took 12 young people to a field about a kilometer away, and they broke both their arms and their legs. They selected them randomly from the village of Huwara, and they broke both both hands and feet, bones. But as a sign of their generosity, they left one of them with just broken arms and left his legs intact, so that he can walk back to the village and summon the help for that. During that uprising, by the way, 1987 uprising, it's a fascinating uprising, and lessons from it for us Palestinians should give us some wisdom about how to do things and what works and what doesn't work, really, with such a colonial oppressors. I will read a section from that uprising. This is page 145. On December 15, 1988, the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People, PCR, this is a center that I'm now the chairman of the board, issued an invitation to Israelis of goodwill to come to Beit Sahur. The invitation read in part, "A taste of peace. What would it look like when Israel and Palestine live together in peace? A town in the West Bank invites you to tour sites in what will someday be the Palestinian state, and taste today the peace of tomorrow. Come as guests, not as occupiers." A day after the invitation was sent, Israeli occupation forces escalated their attacks on Palestinian civilians in the area, killing several and injuring dozens. The day of the visit opened on Sunday, December 18, 1988, with the occupation army declaring Beit Sahur a closed military zone. The residents checked the location of army roadblocks in Beit Sahur and found that it was still possible to go by road from Jerusalem through Tekoa, which is linked to Beit Sahur by a small back road. This was used by settlers but had no military checkpoint at the time. A convoy of 20 cars carrying 70 Israelis, including Knesset member Ran Cohen, arrived and was warmly welcomed. The gathering was held in the church and opened with the Palestinian national anthem. This is, by the way, 1988, when you would be punished by 1 year in jail for raising a Palestinian flag or singing the Palestinian national anthem, Biladi Biladi, followed by a speech to welcome from the mayor, Hanna Latrash, who declared that force and oppression can never force Palestinians to end their intifada, their struggle for justice, peace, and independence, end of quote. On July 1, 1989, Israeli forces arrested 14 individuals in Beit Sahur, whom they considered to be the leaders of the tax revolt, and held them in administrative detention, detention without trials. Some of them were involved, most notably Fouad Kokeli, Hazem Kumsiya, this is my brother-in-law, by the way, and Ghassan Ndoni, who's the founder of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. I'll stop reading, but I'll just briefly tell you about the tax revolt. The tax revolt was when my town, the village of Beit Sahur, decided not to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation authorities. The title of this campaign in 1988 was "No Taxation Without Representation." For obvious reasons, We were paying taxes to the Israeli occupation authorities that were using them to build Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, to fund their army. That's what they were using them for, not for our schools or hospitals or anything else. So what did the army do when all 12,000 people in Beit Sahur refused to pay taxes? The army came, surrounded the town with tanks and armored personnel carriers, and proceeded to pillage the town while laying curfew and siege on the town, preventing food supplies, things like that. When I say pillage the town, it means they took just about everything that's of value. When people, they came to their houses, said, you have $10,000, 10,000 shekels, you have to pay taxes. Okay, you won't pay taxes, we're going to take your furniture, your TV, everything. They even went into pharmacies. Beit Sahur was depleted of medicines because they took all the medicines, because the pharmacists refused to pay their taxes, supposed taxes. These taxes were arbitrary and were not really anything relative to the income of those people. Many of them could not afford anyway, even if they wanted to pay. The Israeli army was desperate. Even though they laid curfew to the town did not give up. Curfew, by the way, means you cannot get out of your house. You cannot move in the street. And yet the people refused to give up. They refused to surrender. There were instances where they offered people, okay, you don't want to pay 10,000 shekels, pay us 100 shekels. And sign on the paper that you paid your taxes and we'll let you keep your furniture. Okay, not 100 shekels, one shekel. It reached with one guy, they offered him to pay one agora, which is like one penny, if he would just sign the paper that he paid the one penny taxes and that they would leave him his furniture, and he refused. There were amazing stories of heroism. During this tax revolt is when the Beit Sahur people called on the international communities, including Israelis of goodwill, human rights activists, peace activists, to come join us in the struggle and to break the siege on Beit Sahur. And we succeeded in breaking the siege of Beit Sahur. Now, I read to you two examples, one from the uprising of 1920-21 and one from the uprising of 1987. But really, even the book itself is the tip of the iceberg of Palestinian nonviolent resistance over 130 years. And we in Palestine, of course, believe that this is a human rights struggle for all people. We don't think that this is a struggle just for the Palestinians. I myself, by the way, was arrested with Israeli Jews who tied themselves to bulldozers that were uprooting trees, that destroying livelihood of people. So we have so many inspiring stories, it's hard to even, in a book like this, to even give samples, you know, hors d'oeuvres, if you want, in food, we say, of the various things. The inspiring and very successful and hopeful, that's why the subtitle is A History of Hope and Empowerment. I will say one thing before I read the last paragraph, as just an example of the success, because many, by the way, even Palestinians in America and in the Arab world say, well, what's the use, you know, it's not working. You know, we haven't received our liberation yet, right? Well, no, that's not true. We have succeeded in many, many areas. I mean, the fact that we have 5.5 million Palestinians between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean is a testament to the success of this resistance. Because the Zionist Project was very clear from its foundation about what its intention. Maximum geography with minimum demography, that's how they articulated it. They didn't want a lot of Palestinians left. They wanted as minimum number of Palestinians as possible. And they did everything in their power to drive us out. In 1948, 530 villages between November 1947 to the end of 1949, 530 villages were depopulated. Half of them, by the way, before the State of Israel was even founded in May 14, 1948. And yet, even this sad picture of 1947, 48, and 49, you can see the positives in it, because you can see that Palestinians tried to return to their villages. 3,000 of them were shot, villagers trying to return to their village, because the first order after the ceasefire that was given to the Israeli army, new State of Israel, when it was founded and became Israeli army instead of the underground Haganah and other forces, The first order given to the Israeli army was to shoot on sight any Palestinians who tried to return to their villages. And nearly 3,000 people lost their lives trying to return to their villages in acts of nonviolent resistance. And indeed, nearly, you know, it's hard to know the exact numbers because nobody, you know, made these calculations. But 20 to 30,000 did indeed succeed in returning to their homes and villages, to the chagrin of the new state of Israel. And what are you going to do after that? You know, the ceasefire is declared already. It's hard now to pick 1,000 or 10,000 people and put them outside after the ceasefire is declared. So that's an act of nonviolent resistance. I'll give one other example of success. You heard about the wall, the apartheid wall that Israel is building in the West Bank. It was started in the West Bank in 2002. Of course, it was completed in Gaza long before that, in the 1990s, even before suicide bombings, by the way, it was completed in Gaza. But the wall that was started in the West Bank was started in 2002. And it was slated to cost about $2.5 billion, and it was slated to be finished in less than 4 years. Here we are, more than 8 years later, more than $8 billion in cost, and it's not even 70% complete. 70%. It's very porous, by the way. I myself entered Jerusalem 4 times without a permit. Israel says, I, as a Palestinian, cannot enter Jerusalem. It's only 6 miles away from my home in Beit Lahem, but I cannot enter Jerusalem. Even though, by the way, I have a U.S. passport, I cannot enter Jerusalem. And yet I entered it 4 times, as I said. So the reality of it, you can see why did the wall cost more than 3 times as much and take more than, twice as long, and it's still not 70% complete, and in my humble opinion will never be complete. It's because of Palestinian resistance. Every time the bulldozers come to try to clear away some trees for the wall or destroy something to build a wall, every time the workers come, we stand in front of them. You know, this is what nonviolent resistance is, something that, again, is not mentioned or discussed in the Western media. If we believe that we must wait for others to do something for us, we are doomed to fail. Not as quote-unquote Palestinians, quote-unquote Israelis, or quote-unquote Americans, but as humans. We can find some useful guidance in our varied backgrounds, whether philosophical, religious, or cultural. In the Arab Islamic tradition, we say, وَلَا يُغَيِّرُ اللَّهُ مَا بِقَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيِّرُوا مَا بِأَنفُسِهِمْ. Verily, God does not change the condition of a people until they change what is within themselves. We can draw inspiration from what millions of Palestinians have done over the past 130 years to successfully challenge and hinder the Zionist project. That project of transforming Palestine from multi-ethnic and multi-religious society into a quote-unquote Jewish state is destined to fail, not only because of the resistance, but because of its internal contradictions and increasingly apparent racism. History will not be kind to any of us if we do not do all we can to accelerate the inevitable arrival of justice, which carries with it the sweet fruits of peace.
You've been listening to a talk by Professor Mazen B. Kumsia about his book Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. The talk was delivered at the University of Connecticut bookstore, the Co-op, in March. Professor Kumsia teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities in occupied Palestine. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Our website is talknationradio.org. Our music is by Fritz Heed.